This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. Your source for Pan-African news and world developments, I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yehi Suhib coming up on Africa News Tonight.
So people are very suspicious that by this weekend a lot of things can happen in terms of fraud.
That's VOA's Abdurrahman Dia reporting from Kinshasa. Details next.
Also, in about 7 weeks, Nigeria holds national elections. President Muhammadu Buhari of the All Progressives Party faces more than a dozen rivals in the race. And Somalia asked the UN Special Representative Nicholas Haysom to leave the country for meddling in the country's sovereignty.
We'll have these stories and lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
With internet access cut off for the third day, the DRC is on edge, waiting for official results of Sunday's presidential election amid allegations of cheating and intimidation. The government has said the cutoff decision was the result of concerns that rumors could fuel a popular uprising because fictitious results were circulating on social media. The top three candidates have all said they believe they're in the lead. International election monitors have praised the government for holding fairly peaceful voting while adding that they hope the results match the people's wishes. VOA staffer Abdurrahami Dia is in Kinshasa. He spoke with my colleague Paul Alexander about the mood in the country and concerns of violence.
The SADC observers, as well as the African Union mission, gave their preliminary results on what they saw during election day and before that in the process. So both SADC, the Southern African Community, and the African Union actually congratulated the government for self-funding this election, and also seemed to be very happy that the election was peacefully, generally, although they regretted the death in some part of the country. But SADC, the SADC, said that the election was well managed and was relatively smooth given the challenges that the country has been facing. They said that the Electoral Commission and the government have done their best, and I'm sure that is something that both the Electoral Commission and the government will be very happy to hear. However, the African Union, I think, was more critical, and they noted several issues like voting machine issues, malfunctions, the lack of voter list in some areas. Although they said that overall they think the Electoral Commission did its best, the conclusion, though, was very, in my view, was kind of a warning, because although they said it was a victory for the Congolese people in the way they conducted themselves on election day, the African Union says that it wishes that the result will be proclaimed would reflect the real wishes of the people.
From what you're hearing, is that a realistic wish?
Well, people are very skeptical and they are suspicious. Especially with the internet being out, they don't know why. There is no official explanation. The opposition already said that this was a way to organize fraud. There are also some ballots that were found in a river in South Kivu that allegedly was ballots that were casted for Felix Tshisekedi. So people are very suspicious that by this weekend, a lot of things can happen in terms of fraud.
You know, given the bloodshed that followed Zimbabwe's election, do you see a way that Congo gets through the next couple of weeks without some violence?
Well, at least from the people I'm talking to, whether they are Congolese or foreigners coming here to observe or cover the election, they are basically saying that anything could happen.
Is there a strong security presence around Kinshasa and elsewhere?
Yes, we have seen a little bit more military out than the days before. And there are some people saying that they actually the military has been ordered to come. Some of them have been deployed in numbers in some areas of Kinshasa, coming from other provinces. We cannot confirm that, but we are told that some people, some military, came from other provinces into Kinshasa. Kinshasa is very slow because the country is in its third day without internet, which really affects the activities here, and people are really upset about that. So they are hoping that whatever happens, they will get their means of communication back. Even the church came out asking for the government to bring back the internet, as well as the European Union and the United States.
That was VOA staffer Abdurahami Dia speaking from Kinshasa with my colleague Paul Alexander.
In about 7 weeks, Nigeria holds national elections. President Muhammadu Buhari of the All Progressive Party faces more than a dozen rivals in the race. Atiku Abubakar of the People's Democratic Party is considered his strongest rival. Recently, VOA House of Service managing editor Aliyu Mustafa interviewed both candidates in their Abuja homes. On Monday, we brought you their thoughts on national security. Today, we bring you the candidates' comments about the country's problem with corruption. President,
yes, there will always be people who will be prepared to offer bribes, and but what we feel is just like the military operation. Whoever is caught accepting bribe, you know, will certainly be dealt with. Don't forget that a certain limit of expenditure has to come to Federal Executive Council. And you know the Constitution says there must be at least one member from each state in the Executive Council. Now, some have substantive ministries, some are ministers of state and are working with other senior ministers. And every expenditure that by Constitution has to come to Executive Council, members of the Council are allowed to make a comment. You see? So in that respect, and it's recorded. And look at the Office of the Accountant General, the Office of the Auditor General. So there are checks and balances. And I would like people who are making accusing of lack of progress in checking corruption to check what have these offices have done for the 3.5 years we have been in position. Have they been allowed to prosecute cases? How many of those cases pass through under our noses?
That was Nigeria's President Muhammadu Buhari defending his government's record on trying to reduce corruption. VOA's Aliyu Mustafa posed the same question about corruption to candidate Atiku Abubakar, noting that the People's Democratic Party candidate himself has been accused of corruption.
I have challenged everybody publicly and otherwise that if you have any evidence of corruption against me, whether when I was a public officer or as a politician, feel free to go to EFCC or to go to the public or to go to the court and say, but nobody has come. So it's
So how would you fight? You do admit there is corruption in Nigeria, right?
And just like in any other country, that
so
is
how would you arrest
it's only the levels of corruption that...
What would you do about that, the corruption thing?
Well, I mean, you just have to strengthen your laws and also strengthen your processes to make sure that people don't escape, and also make sure that people who are accused of corruption, you know, are, you know, tried in a very, very fast manner so that you don't allow... I certainly will not agree or allow a situation where corrupt trials last for several years. I don't think it's good for justice.
Atiku Abubakar, the leading opposition candidate in Nigeria's February 16th presidential election, was speaking with VOA's Aliyu Mustafa in Abuja.
Some Somalia has asked the UN Special Representative Nicholas Haysom to leave the country for meddling in the country's sovereignty. On Monday, Haysom urged the Somali government to safeguard human rights. His letter specifically asks for explanations about atrocities allegedly committed in Baidoa last month during protest over the arrest of former al-Shabaab leader Muktar Rabaul. Rabaul has been excluded from elections. Just hours before the Somali government's letter of expulsion was released to the media yesterday, two UN staff members and a contractor were injured after seven mortars landed inside the UN compound in the Somali city capital, Mogadishu. Al-Shabaab claimed responsibility for the attack.
Struggling Zimbabwe workers and families are growing increasingly frustrated with the country's weakening economy, with several professional groups on strike. The National Labor Organization plans a nationwide strike this month, and the opposition Movement for Democratic Change also calls for more labor action. Reporter Adi Gondo gives us more on the story.
Many Zimbabweans say the country's leadership seems to be ignorant about the suffering of millions. The government continues to blame economic sanctions for shortages of currency, rising inflation, and food shortages. At a church service in Bulawayo this week, Vice President Constantine Chiwenga took a religious tone. Using the biblical analogy of the children of Israel, he bemoaned Zimbabwe's lack of patience with the government as it implements reforms aimed at delivering a better life for its citizens. He returned to an old ruling ZANU-PF argument that the economic problems are part of the cost of the country's land reform program.
And as the story of Israel tells us, this gift does not come cheap. We struggle for it the same way the children of Israel struggled for it.
But some Zimbabweans were angry about being asked to be patient, given rising prices, shortages of goods, and the lack of cash. Those problems are being compounded by the month-long doctor's strike. Bulawayo resident Ronald Mhlanga is among those who are angry.
It's really unfortunate for the powers that be to feel that Zimbabweans are inconsiderate by demanding that they fix the economy. They've been patient, I think, for close to 4 decades now. Zimbabweans have endured inhuman conditions without actually revolting. So the government and current leadership should count themselves like really. And what Zimbabweans expect is for them to fix the economy and not to push them to the wall.
School teacher Martha Dube was also not happy with Chiwenga's speech.
Likening Zimbabwe to the children of Israel, the comparison is appropriate if you want to liken Gabi to a pharaoh. However, the reasons for our suffering cannot be accredited to sanctions, because the reason why our suffering is because of ZANU-PF. That's very obvious. Because I don't see how sanctions come into the issue of MPs being bought all these luxurious cars. I don't see how sanctions come into that.
ZANU-PF last year purchased luxury cars for several of its top officers at a cost of hundreds of thousands of dollars. Zimbabwe, while rich in mineral resources and once an agricultural breadbasket, has seen its economy slump for decades, in part because of mismanagement, including the seizure and redistribution of commercial farmland owned by white Zimbabweans. Western economic sanctions imposed over the government's human rights abuses have also compounded the problems. The country has no functional currency, and it is burdened with debt. The country's Auditor General last year issued a damning report about state-owned enterprises, saying they were riddled with corruption. Reporting for VOA, this is Adi Gondo.
Coming up on 19 minutes past the hour, this is African News Tonight on the Voice of America. Remittances have long provided a lifeline to those in poor countries, as relatives working overseas provide funds for school fees, medical expenses, and other needs. The World Bank says remittances to emerging economies rose to a record $528 billion in 2018, with a 10% increase to Africa. The money that the diaspora sends back home keeps about 3.5 million children in school worldwide. The system has become a generational tradition in some families. Joy Kayakwita was in school in Uganda when her father died. Her older sister, who was working abroad, picked up her school cost. Now Kayakwita is a lawyer in Britain and has paid the school fees of 9 children in Uganda. She spoke with our colleague Paul Alexander.
And it became a tradition because, you know, both my parents were teachers and we believe in education so much. So even when I came here to study, you know, after studying, I took on responsibilities back home. And when my brother passed away in 2015, I officially took on the responsibility of paying fees for his children. So, and I know for sure if I don't send the money to them, nobody else is going to give them money, and they don't have the money on the ground.
Not long ago, sending money was often a laborious process that could involve days. It's being replaced by electronic transfers. Kayaguita says her brother-in-law died just as his son was going for his college entrance exams. She was able to send money to his school within minutes, just in time to take the exams. She says the speedier process is also critical for medical emergencies.
When a child is sick, you know, I can tell you so many stories of what goes on back home. A child is very sick, you know, they want to take the child to hospital, but there is no money on ground. And then you just have to send money, and within 10 minutes, they have got the money and they have gone to the hospital. For me, I think this thing is like a lifesaver, you know, for educational purposes, but also for the general well-being of, you know, of our families back home in every way.
Greg Thwaites of World Remit, one of the biggest remittance transfer companies, says digital transfers also are cheaper than older methods.
So our research shows that digital remittances are about 30% cheaper than the traditional kind. Our research also shows that migrants, when they send money home, can keep maybe 3.5 million children around the world in school. And we show that if all remittances were to go digital, then given the amount of money that people typically spend from their remittances on education, that could be another $800 million available for education in low and lower middle income countries, particularly in Africa.
But some cash-strapped countries look at remittances as a potential cash cow and want to tax them. Thwaites says that's short-sighted because of the benefits remittances bring already.
We recognize that governments need to raise money, and it's important for them to remember that remittances already bring them in revenues. Remittances, because they increase the spending power of the receiving countries, increase value-added tax receipts, income tax receipts, they lead to the growth of businesses and so on. They pay for imports, which generate customs revenues. So governments already get a lot of tax from remittances without taxing them directly.
Thwaites says that if all remittances were sent digitally, the savings over other methods would equal 20 million school uniforms, 30 million school books, and 16 million sets of school supplies.
Officials in Burkina Faso today said at least 13 people died when suspected jihadists attacked a village in the north-central part of the country. The French news agency reports gunmen on motorbikes attacked the village yesterday morning. Also yesterday, 37 civilians were killed in neighboring Mali in what appeared to be ethnic violence between herding and hunting groups. State television in Mali said men dressed as hunters attacked a village in central Mali. Burkina Faso and Mali both have been hit by sporadic outbreaks of sectarian and ethnic violence over the past decade. Islamist groups linked with Al-Qaeda and other militant organizations are struggling to gain territory, while rival ethnic groups come into conflict over scarce water, grazing land, and other resources.
Twenty-two Sudanese political parties and groups, including some close to the government, have called for a new government. The call comes after more than 2 weeks of protests across the country over its declining economy. They say President Omar al-Bashir's government cannot overcome neither the current political crisis nor regional and international isolation. The groups called for a new transitional government that would hold elections for restoring democracy and public freedoms. Nabil Nagam is a political analyst of African Affairs based in Cairo. He explained to VOA senior analyst Mohamed El-Shenawy that President Bashir may find himself in a tight situation.
I believe very much that President Omar Hassan al-Bashir had long blamed for his country's poverty and isolation. This move by those winning two political parties or political bodies, meaning that those guys who were in the same bed with President Omar al-Bashir are leaving him. And now he is getting closer and closer around the presidential ballot in Khartoum.
The group called for a new transitional government that would hold elections for restoring democracy and public freedoms. Is that doable in a peaceful way? And whom among the Sudanese leaders could emerge as a new leader who can get the international support?
Actually, it is very much early to talk about a specific Sudanese politician. But let's go back to basics. This Islamic-oriented military regime have dominated the Sudanese politics since June 1989. This regime came to power in a military coup, and the president himself faces two international arrest warrants based on charges of war crimes and crimes against humanity and genocide in the Darfur. Actually, the situation in Khartoum or in Sudan at large doesn't look good at all. The poverty level, the lack of necessities, the Sudanese citizens are suffering. So President Bashir has got not too much choices. He's got to listen to the voices of the Sudanese people, and he's got to really re-evaluate his stance. He is not in a situation to maneuver. He's got to come to the common sense and find a peaceful way to avoid wide, massive riots and destruction in Sudan.
But the president of Sudan, Omar al-Bashir, ordered the setting up of a fact-finding committee headed by the justice minister to investigate violence during the anti-government protests. Would that calm the popular uprising in Sudan?
I don't believe so. A fact-finding mission formed by a regime which has lost its credibility among the people. The people went out after they have waited for 30 years. 30 years of no real improvement, no real achievements. The inflation rate is 74%. The U.S. dollar is equal to 80 Sudanese pound. The foreign debt is almost 47 billion U.S. dollars. So coming back to this fact-finding mission, who would trust a fact-finding mission of a regime which internationally has been doomed of killing or accused of killing 300,000 citizens in Darfur, in west of Sudan, between 2003 and 2018. I do believe very much that it is another way to gain time, but I don't think it's very much promising to the Sudanese president, Omar Hassan al-Bashir.
That was Nabil Nagam, a political analyst of African Affairs. He spoke to VOA's Mohammed El-Shenawy.
And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehiyas Wahib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Please stay tuned to Straight Talk Africa coming up at 18:30 UTC. On behalf of our producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Alfredo Santos, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Hello, this is Shaka Sali, host of Straight Talk Africa.
Anger over rising prices, shortages of bread and fuel, and a cash crisis has incited demonstrations across Sudan and against President Omar al-Bashir. Is Sudan in the precipice of change? An in-depth discussion on the politics of Sudan on the next Straight Talk Africa.
Tune in Wednesdays at 18:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.
Hey, sports fans, brighten your day by tuning in to the sunny side of sports Monday through Friday at 16:30 and 18:30 UTC. Join us on Facebook at facebook.com/VOA Sunny and on Twitter at VOA Sunny Sports. Or check out the blog at blogs.voanews.com/sunny. It's the sunny side of sports right here on the Voice of America.
Looking for something? Headline news? Interviews? Analysis? We've got it all on voaafrica.com.
voaafrica.com.